Well, thank you, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me. It's certainly a treat to get to come to Santa Barbara. Today, I want to tell you about some work that I've been doing on jamming, and this is work that I've been doing with a student of mine, and to make sure he gets credit, this is what he looks like. In hopefully not too many years, he might be looking for a postdoc, so remember that face. So, as I said, the title is Jamming Shapes Up, Geometry and Energy Landscape Near the Jamming Transition, and a very, very, very brief overview of jamming in granular materials is basically that chunks are different, right? That if you've got a big solid piece of something, we've got a pretty good handle on how to deal with it, right? Physics is good at dealing with crystals, with order, with defects in order even. But once we go to a system like this pile of sand, this system of an enormous number of very, you know, discrete individual chunks, we have to throw out a lot of our tools, right? We can't talk about it in terms of equilibrium systems. We don't have the concept of temperature to help us, so we are sort of at a loss of how to deal with it, right? We have to deal with the fact that granular materials are neither solid nor liquid nor gas, and that they are an athermal state of matter. If you wait for the age of the universe, this pile of sand is never going to organize itself into its minimum energy configuration. It's going to stay stuck in its local sort of metastable state. So, I told you this would be fast. We get to the jamming transition, which is essentially what happens when I take a whole bunch of chunks, right, be it spheres, grains of sand, what have you, and I push them together enough that they start to push back. And there's been this idea in the field that the jamming transition is intimately related to the glass transition. This is molten glass. And so in the glass transition, you have, say, in a molecular glass, you've got a liquid which, as it cools, every particle starts to get in the way of every other particle until it gets arrested. Now, it's not in its lowest energy configuration, it's not in a crystal, but it's in a state in which particles can no longer move. In order to move one particle, you would have to create motion throughout the entire system. This is exactly what happens in a jammed system of, say, spheres. When the spheres get dense enough, they interfere with one another, and the entire system becomes frustrated to the point where, in order to make a local change, in order to move one particle past another, you're forced to make a global change. So this is what we talk about when we talk about jamming. And there's been this idea that we could unify this, and I'm sure some of you are groaning at yet another example of the jamming phase transition, but for those of you who haven't seen it, I think it's useful. The notion is that we can combine the idea of a glass transition and a jamming transition by thinking about it in terms of three axes. In terms of temperature, if you heat a system, it will melt. In terms of packing fraction, if you make a system more dense, so this is inverse packing fraction, we use phi to denote packing fraction, if you make a system more dense, eventually, there's nowhere for particles to go. They can't pass one another. They get stuck. And then finally, in terms of shear, if you push the system hard enough, you can break it. And so the idea is to come up with a global or unified understanding of this jamming and glass transition that is so far from equilibrium. Now, there's not a whole lot that we know a priori. Historically, people have looked at this jamming transition in terms of the mechanics. And that's really been driven by, I think, this notion of Maxwell's criterion, which was, I think, probably James Clerk Maxwell's signature contribution to science. I'm not sure he did much else of note. So the Maxwell criterion is really saying, if you've got a system of particles, let's say I've got a bucket full of marbles, right? And each time I pour those marbles into that bucket, they take on a different state. But always, they're in this jammed state. So I pour them in, and then, for example, I could stand on it. But every time I pour them in, every particle is in a different place. Is there anything that is generic, anything that is always true that I can say about it? Well, one thing I see is every time I pour it in, they end up with a packing fraction of about 64%. But I don't really understand why. Another thing I can say, though, is when I pour them in, every particle is constrained, right? That's what it means for it to be jammed, that every particle, barring some rattlers, which I don't really want to think about right now, will be constrained. And so that means that we need to have a balance of the number of degrees of freedom and the number of constraints. This leads us to say that in 3D, we need to have 2D equals 6 constraints per particle, right? So we need to have 6 contacts per particle. So this realization has eventually led to some really incredible advances, which a number of people in the audience are responsible for, looking at the scaling of, for example, the number of contacts with increased density as I jam the system even harder, and then looking at the scaling of other mechanical properties, properties like bulk modulus, shear modulus, energy, pressure, etc., with increased packing fraction. This is not the direction I want to go, because the problem with this is that if I take my system and I unjam it, for example, if I just shrink every particle a tiny bit, all of a sudden, this number of contacts goes precisely to zero, and all of the mechanical properties fall precisely to zero. And so while these are wonderful order parameters for looking at systems that are above jamming, by above jamming I mean denser than the jamming transition, they kind of fall down when we're looking below jamming. So what I want to do is talk about order parameters that work below jamming, and here I would argue that geometry is all that we have. So if we look at this, this is basically a little cartoon showing what happens as I increase the packing fraction up to the jamming transition and above. So in red lines, we have the network of nearest neighbors. And so the nearest neighbors we can extract from a Voronoi construction. I'll talk about that in a moment. So we see that when we are very far from jamming, we have one network of nearest neighbors. And then as we bring particles close to one another, that network can change, right? And in particular, as we bring particles close to one another, that network can evolve. You can lose neighbors, you can gain neighbors, etc. And then only when you hit the jamming transition do some of these red links turn into blue links. And the blue links are actual physical contacts. And so you see we've got this discontinuity in the network of contacts, but the network of nearest neighbors is continuously defined over all our phase space. So what we're going to do in this talk is see whether the network of nearest neighbors contains signatures of the jamming transition, and if so, what does it do below the jamming transition? What might that tell us about the jamming transition? The way we're going to do it is with simulations, and the reason is because, among other things, we want to vary dimension. So we're going to do simulations in which we can vary dimension and packing fraction. And the reason, briefly, to vary dimension is because, as we'll see, certain behavior becomes simpler and sharper as we go to higher dimensions, just as in many other sorts of, many other sorts of physical systems, you're able to leave behind any evidence of the low-dimensional things that are particular to a particular dimension, and instead discover generic features that are true of the interaction in the geometry. So what I do in particular is I've got periodic boundary conditions. I throw a bunch of particles into a box. I have an overlap potential, so I've got some potential which is only there when particles are in contact, so a contact potential. And I put particles at random, which simulates essentially infinite temperature, and then I do a quench down to temperature zero. And so I essentially let the particles relax to their nearest potential energy minimum. So this is sort of like finding the inherent structure, which is something that's been talked about in other fields. And I do this using either conjugate gradient minimization or this newer fast inertial relaxation engine. And I do it on a wonderful GPU cluster that the University of Oregon has. This allows me to do many, many systems very, very quickly, and I can go to pretty big systems. So the way in which I analyze my data is that I look at the Voronoi cell. So for those of you who are less familiar with this, the Voronoi cell around a particle is defined by all space closest to a given sphere. So it's a way of segmenting space into the part of space that's closest to me, closer to me than anybody else. So what this does for me is this gives me now a cell around my particle, and I can look at the geometric features of that cell. So I can look at things like number of sides, maximum inscribed sphere, surface area, volume, aspect ratio, moment of inertia, any number of things that are all defined on both sides of this jamming transition. And I can look at how these things change as a function of phi. So the simplest thing to me to look at is the number of sides. And so the number of sides is really telling me the number of neighbors, the number of nearest neighbors, because if you and I are a nearest neighbor in this jammed packing, then there exists a plane, there exist points that are equidistant from you and me, but closer to you and me than to any other particle. So if that's the case, we're neighbors. So now we can calculate, surprisingly, we can calculate analytically what the mean number of neighbors will be if we are at zero density. So if I just have randomly distributed points, essentially a Poisson process, I can calculate the average number of neighbors. It works out to be a wonderful number. It's something like 48 pi squared over 35 plus 2. And it's a lovely mathematical result. But so I can calculate what happens at zero density. And then I can make a bit of an argument that as I go to higher density, I can imagine swelling particles, and they push off of one another. And so as they push off of one another, they're sort of shouldering one another out of the way, and so I have fewer and fewer neighbors. So the sort of zero hypothesis would be that as I increase the density of a system, the mean number of neighbors should fall. And then you ask, well, what should happen as I go through this jamming transition? So at the jamming transition, particles that were just about to kiss finally do kiss. So you would think that there shouldn't necessarily be any geometric signature of that. It's such a small change. Certainly, the average number of neighbors has to be continuous as we go through that change. So we do this, and we do this for dimensions 3 through 8, and this is what we find. So to orient you on this graph, this is the scaled mean number of neighbors versus scaled packing fraction. So I've scaled the packing fraction such that jamming is at 0, zero density is at minus 1, and then twice the jamming density is at 1. And I've scaled the mean number of neighbors such that the mean number of neighbors is at 0 at jamming, and then I've essentially done mean number of neighbors minus the number of neighbors at jamming divided by the number of neighbors at jamming. So we see what we'd expect at low density. We see that the mean number of neighbors decreases at low density. But then we see right at jamming, we have a kink, right? Right at jamming, we have some characteristic change in how the network of nearest neighbors evolves with increasing density. And so it may be less clear, but right here I've got the d equals 2 result. So I've got d equals 2, 3, all the way up to 8. And we see that dimensions 3 through 8 all collapse onto one another when scaled appropriately. However, dimension 2 looks totally different. And the reason why it looks totally different is because in 2D we are constrained by the Euler criterion, such that in 2D our Voronoi cells are just polygons, and in 2D, any packing, any tiling of 2D space with polygons is required to have, on average, precisely 6 neighbors, precisely 6 sides, on average, for the polygon. And so we can see that geometrically there's something very, very different about two dimension from three and higher. And so we can also see this if we look at other moments of this neighbor distribution, etc. But what we would claim is that at least for this order parameter, the mean number of neighbors, this transition has an upper critical dimension of somewhere between 2 and 3, which is sort of strange. We can also see that if we look at this on a log-log plot, so this is the same data plotted for systems above jamming and systems below jamming, that it looks like we come into this jamming transition with a power law. And it's a power law with an exponent somewhere around 0.7 or 0.8, something like that. And so this to me is kind of shocking. This is telling me that this point here, this jamming point, controls the geometry even far below jamming, right? Because if I know a couple of points below jamming, I can predict where the jamming transition will be, right? This is the value of it being a power law. And so somehow the structure of space, of sphere packings below jamming, is still controlled by this jamming transition. But how does this square with mechanics? Well, we know from Corey in the audience, that mechanical jamming has an upper critical dimension that is less than or equal to 2. So this, to me, is a real puzzle, and I'm afraid I don't have anything very intelligent to say about it. Somehow we have to square the fact, and here I've plotted log z minus zj, which is the mean number of contacts minus the number of contacts at jamming, against phi minus phi j, the difference from the jamming transition. And you see that in d equals 2 and d equals 3, you get the same power laws. And likewise, I can plot energy of the packing versus the deviation in packing fraction. And we see, again, all the same power laws. I point out my 20 decades of data on this graph, which I'm a little bit proud of. So I don't know how to square this. Is it that I have two different transitions with different upper critical dimensions that happen to coincide at precisely this same jamming transition? Or is it that I have the same underlying physics which is manifesting in two order parameters with two different upper critical dimensions? And is that part of why this jamming and glass transition is so difficult to deal with? So if anybody has interesting ideas about that, I'm all ears. So moving on, we can all ask, can we do anything to this result? Can we change this behavior? So one thing we could imagine doing is changing the polydispersity. So perhaps this result is something that is special just because I'm using monodispersed spheres. The real world is full of polydispersity, and so maybe this could all fall apart. So in this panel, I've varied the polydispersity. I've used a log normal distribution of particle size, but it doesn't matter. And I've again scaled every system back to the same scaling. You can see in red is the monodisperse. And going up in shades of gray, I go out to 20 or 30% polydispersity with this log normal distribution. And I get no change at all close to the jamming transition. Far from it, I do get changes, and that's because the actual value, the mean number of neighbors at jamming, depends on the polydispersity, and the density at which you jam depends on the polydispersity. Yeah?
Sorry, since these are contact neighbors, sorry, geometric neighbors and not contact neighbors, can you just sort of say the numbers at the jamming point?
Oh, of course. I'm sorry. I should have. Yes. So at the jamming point in d equals 3, you've got about 14.2 geometric neighbors. And you contrast this with at zero density, you've got about 15.5. So then as you go higher up in dimension, those numbers rise exponentially to the point where in 8D, I think you've got about 800 neighbors. In 4D, you've got about 25 neighbors, something like that. So another thing that we can do is we can change the interparticle potential. So the data that I've shown you has been done with a contact potential that is harmonic. We could change that. We could make it Hertzian. We could make it, you know, to the 1.5. So this is what I've done here. So I've got interparticle contact potentials going from 1.5, 2, 2.5, 3, 3.5, and 4. And you can see that below jamming, the interparticle contact potential doesn't matter. And that doesn't make, that's not such a surprise. It can't matter because below jamming, the energy is always zero. This is the value of using a geometric order parameter. Yes?
This is the number of nearest neighbors, not the number of contacting neighbors, correct?
That is correct, because the number of contacting neighbors below jamming is precisely zero, and the number of contacting neighbors above jamming is going to be whatever scaling everybody else has seen. Yes?
Can you just make a quick comment on that, Eric?
Yeah. Yes.
And that's very, make that very definitively.
Yeah.
I want you to sort of talk about that, because if the potential is very dissipative, the particles will be very, very close together.
Yes. So that is an excellent point. So I say that the number of contacting neighbors is zero. But I also, the way that I'm doing these minimizations is I am pushing particles off until the energy goes to zero. So I'm left with a lot of particles that are kissing. And so I'm making the distinction between contacting and non-contacting by force carrying. So below jamming, none of these particles are able to carry forces, right? Because if we put a little force on it, it is unconstricted, and so we'll just move away. But yes, it is the case that I have particles that are arbitrarily close. Do you have more to say about that? Okay. All right. So to conclude here, we just say that the potential doesn't matter below jamming. So what we're left with is really that nothing else matters, right? That this is universal behavior. There's nothing that I can do to change this. If I start with particles that are randomly distributed in space, I do an infinite quench of temperature, and then so I move to the inherent configuration, then I swell particles, or I just do an infinite temperature quench at a particular packing fraction, I always get this behavior. So there are other things I can do. I can look at the maximum inscribed sphere. So What this is I can say, here's my Voronoi cell. What is the biggest sphere that I could put inside of it? So I blow up a balloon inside of my Voronoi cell and ask, what is the radius of that balloon? So if we think about it, below jamming, that maximum inscribed sphere will always be bigger than the particle itself, right? Because since particles aren't touching, there's freedom for them to move, so the maximum inscribed sphere can be larger. In general, the maximum inscribed sphere is a sphere, and so it must be constrained by d plus 1 walls of the Voronoi cell. At jamming, particles are in contact with other particles. They are kissing, they are constrained, and so the maximum inscribed sphere must be exactly equal to the particle itself. And this has an interesting result in that the average number of constraints on that maximum inscribed sphere, the average number of points at which it contacts the Voronoi cell, must be equal to 2d, not d plus 1. Above jamming now, the maximum inscribed sphere is going to be smaller than the physical sphere, because above jamming we have overlap between particles, and again we should fall back to just the generic constraint on a sphere of d plus 1 contacts with the Voronoi cell. So if we look at the in-sphere distribution, we see, well, below jamming, we have a distribution, and I know that this is a nasty graph to read. It's basically looking at r minus r, which is the radius of the in-sphere minus the radius of the particle, divided by L, which is the typical distance between particle centers. So it's just a way of putting them all on the same graph. And here I've got the probability distribution of that. So below jamming, we've got probability distributions that look more or less exponential. Right at jamming, the probability distribution is a delta function. And then above jamming, we have probability distributions that look more or less Gaussian. So what we can do is we can look at the width of these distributions as we get closer to jamming. So if I look at the width of these distributions, if I come from above jamming, I see that the distribution falls to a delta function, right? The width goes to zero right at jamming. However, if I approach from below, I get a very different, very strange behavior. If I approach from below, I find that the width of the distribution falls to zero, telling me that I've got a delta function distribution well below the jamming transition. So I can look at this in more detail by looking at it on a log-log graph. And so let's start with this side. So on this side, we're looking at systems above jamming. As I approach jamming, I can see that the system approaches like a power law, actually a power law with a slope of 1, to a delta function, right? So the width just falls like proportional to the distance to the jamming transition. I can also look at the mean number of contacts that this inscribed sphere has with the Voronoi cell around it. And this mean number of contacts is scaled so that 0 is d plus 1 and 1 is 2d. And I can see that as I come very close to jamming, the mean number of contacts stays at 0 until I get to what is essentially within numerical precision for this data done to double precision. And then it jumps up to the behavior right at jamming. However, if I look from below jamming, I get very different behavior. If I look from below jamming on a log-log graph, I fall off when I'm still, you know, 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2 from jamming. So very, very, very far from jamming. Likewise, if I look at the mean number of contacts that this inscribed sphere has with the Voronoi cell, it jumps up to the jamming behavior when I'm still very, very far from jamming. And notably, it makes this change at just about the same place. So just for the hell of it, what I can do is I can redo this graph, not as phi minus phi j, but as phi minus some phi star, right? Some other point. And when I do that, I observe what looks like a power law here with a slope of negative 2. That seems to be constant as a function of dimension from 3 to 8. Now, you should take this with an enormous grain of salt because you'll see I've only got 2 decades of data here. And this is because it's hard to do a minimization to this phi star because it takes a very long time to calculate these mean number of neighbors. So this is taken with data that is being sort of minimized in steps towards the jamming transition. So I don't have, you know, the 10 decades that I have here. But just based on these 2 decades, it looks like I have a power law going to a different important point. So how can we understand that? Well, we could think that as we are getting towards jamming, and particles are pushing one another away, we're getting to a point at which the cell around a particle gets stuck. Each particle is free to jiggle a tiny little bit in its cell. Right? None of the contacts are yet able to hold forces, but say, you know, 5 of the 6 on average are kissing. And so the particle is essentially geometrically constrained. At this point, there's no more freedom for it to change grossly as it approaches jamming. Yeah. So it's robust in the sense of if I do it over and over, starting at different starting configurations, I get this same behavior. If I do quenches directly to each of these packing fractions, I get the same behavior as if I instead do a sort of series of inflate particles, minimize, inflate, minimize, inflate, minimize. Does that answer your question? I see. If I go in and I move particles around a little bit and then let it re-minimize. So if I do that, it will re-minimize to a different state, but it will have the same sort of statistical properties. Yes. So at this point, I'm 30 minutes in, and I want to talk just a little bit about the idea of renormalization. So we don't have any kind of a field theory in jamming. So the idea is to reverse engineer one by looking at real order parameters and using some kind of a renormalization step, an empirical one, rather than a sort of field theory derived renormalization step. So the expectation is that on any high renormalization step, our order parameter should become a step function as we go through the jamming transition. So the renormalization scheme that we've come up with is essentially to decimate, to coarse grain our system by taking pairs of these Voronoi cells and joining them together, and then looking at the properties of the joined cell, then joining pairs of those together, et cetera, et cetera. In order to make sure that we stay compact, we've introduced one extra feature, which is that we go through and we join pairs together that share big surfaces, right? So if you and I are a cell and we just share a tiny surface, it's unlikely that we'll be joined. If we share a very large interface, then we'll get stuck together. So we pair them together, we calculate quantities for the new cell, we repeat, we repeat, we repeat. I'm going to skip over definition of how we define aspect ratio. We define an aspect ratio. So we look at all of our geometric features, and we notice that they all show signatures of jamming. So here we've got the scaled mean number of neighbors, we've got standard deviation of volume, we've got the surface area of Voronoi cells, we've got a scaled eccentricity or aspect ratio. So now we want to do our renormalization step. So these are complicated graphs, so I will walk you through them. So in blue, I have the original plot for each of these order parameters, which is showing that they go through a change at jamming. So each color as we move up, and this really is a gradient from blue to red, you'll have to believe me, is the behavior after another renormalization step, after another real space renormalization step. So we can see, for example, that if we do this with the scaled mean number of neighbors, this difference gets smaller and smaller and smaller until eventually gets lost in the noise. If we do this with the standard deviation of volume, this difference gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it gets lost in the noise. This is what we'd expect, right? There's no reason for us to believe any of this ought to work. However, if we do this renormalization scheme for surface area, we find that, well, after one step, we get something that looks pretty crappy. But then after two, three, four, five, six steps, we go to some kind of a fixed curve, some kind of a fixed master curve, which is now independent of renormalization step, which means that there's something in this geometric structure that persists as we go to coarser and coarser grain. Even as I step back farther and farther and group together more and more particles, there's something that persists. Likewise, if we look at the scaled eccentricity, we see that we are maybe going towards something that looks a little bit like a step function. So if we pull these out and think about them, we can say for this surface area that this is a master curve that has perfect memory. And by perfect memory, I mean that even after here the 10th or 11th or even 12th renormalization step, by knowing the value of the scaled surface area, I could pick out the value of the packing fraction below jamming. And that means that there's something about this packing fraction that is persisting. There's something about this geometric structure that is persisting and forcing the system at a packing fraction of 0.5 to be different from the system at a packing fraction of 0.4. Likewise, we have similar behavior in our aspect ratio, and this is maybe asymptotically approaching a step function. So maybe this is the thing we're really looking for. This gives us a sense that if we look at this aspect ratio, systems well below jamming go to one kind of behavior, systems well above jamming, or above jamming go to a different kind of behavior, and then intermediate systems seem to interpolate between that. So, am I out of time? One more minute. So, in the last minute, we can ask, you know, we'd expect this kind of rounding off to happen, perhaps due to finite size effects. And so, to that end, we looked at systems of different sizes. And as we increase the size, it doesn't actually become more step-like. So it doesn't seem as if we are necessarily moving towards that perfect step function that we would expect for a lovely phase transition. But perhaps this rounding out here is related to the fact of our phi star, of our other transition that's happening below jamming. And so it could be that you have something more exotic where you've got sort of a continuous phase transition. You've got sort of phase transitions at every point along the way. And this, in some kind of hand-wavy way, ought to connect to some of the behavior that's seen in glass transitions. And I've got oh so much more to tell you, but my time is up. So all I will do is thank you for listening to me and answer any questions you might have.
No, Carl, you can't.
You can probably anticipate the question I'm going to ask. So my question is about kissing contacts. So
yes.
You could look at an analysis of kissing contacts, and the reason why I ask is there have been some studies that have looked at kissing contact percolation, and you can find a phi star for kissing contact percolation that's below jamming, and so I would want to know what your thoughts are about that.
I think that's a good idea. So the reason why we haven't looked at kissing contact is because they're so fragile, right? They feel like they're something that depends an awful lot on the precise way in which you do the minimization. But that's a crappy reason, right? We should just trust our work and go with it. And I think it would be absolutely worth looking at.
So a quick follow-up is I think that the Voronoi construction is sort of you're not quite sure whether they're neighbors that matter. And then there's a spectrum of separations that become more important, like kissing contacts is somewhere between the geometric Voronoi neighbor and the contact, forced contact neighbor. And so there's a few definitions in between. So that's why I think
it's a way of kind of interpolating between the purely mechanical of force bearing contacts and the purely geometric of nearest neighbors. I think it's an excellent idea.
Yeah, very nice presentation.
Thank you.
In this plot, you can see there's some fluctuation in the curve. And maybe you increase the number of atoms.
So the fluctuations are here because this is at high iteration of renormalization. So this is the ninth step. So we've taken 8192, which is 10 to the 12? No. God, that's embarrassing. 10 to the 13? Whatever. We've taken that, we've decimated it by, not 10 to the, 2 to the 12. Sorry. We've decimated it by 2 to the 9. So what's that? Yeah, well. So we've decimated it so much that we're left with not so many cells remaining, which is why this becomes so noisy. So to smooth this out, what we could have done is done many, many, many systems at 8192 and do them all.
So no any special meaning, intrinsic meaning about those observations?
I would hesitate to ascribe meaning to it. I don't think yet that they mean anything. I think if you use enough systems, they would all smooth out.
Thank you.
It seems to me that the statistical ensemble you are using above jamming is a very specific one, which is, of course, useful to prepare configurations above jamming, but I have difficulties seeing its particular meaning below jamming.
So the question is about why I'm using the infinite temperature quench below jamming. Yes.
Not exactly. I mean, it's a very specific statistical ensemble, and yes, why it is.
So I can speak to that a little bit. So I have looked at systems that are prepared as equilibrated liquids, so as thermal liquids, and then I take a snapshot of the thermal liquid, and I do the same analysis on it. And when I do that, I find, if we go back, sorry. So when we do that, I find behavior that is the same right around jamming and different well below jamming. So my claim is that no matter how you prepare the system, if you get sufficiently close to jamming from below, that they fall onto a universal curve. If you are... What's that?
If you're at an infinitesimal temperature, and zero temperature, I don't know what it means.
You don't know what means?
Yes, okay.
Maybe I can rephrase the question.
Yes.
That there's been a lot of work below jamming, as you know.
Yes.
All, a big literature, and they're focused on colloidal glasses where you have Brownian forces, or shear flow where you have shear forces.
Yes.
And then the ensemble is well defined, and there's been a lot of observation showing that the properties are critical as you approach jamming. Even theory have been proposed.
Yes.
So the literature is focused on that because when you're below jamming, you always have some finite forces. Here you have a vacuum that competes with nothing.
Yes.
Which is completely realistic. So the question is, why such the given protocol? Why? How would you observe this in nature? Maybe that would be the question.
So that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure how you would observe this in nature. I could imagine doing something with sort of large particles in which you're swelling them. And so they're large enough that you don't have strong interparticle forces. You swell them, and so you go from the mechanical vacuum of very low density to jamming when they overlap. But I think in a more general sense, to answer your question, what I'm interested in here is the geometric. The geometry of jamming, treating jamming as something purely a result of the way that spheres are able to fill space. And so in that sense, for me, the interparticle forces are not what I'm interested in.
There's lots of interesting and high precision data there that really is interesting to look at. One of the questions I have is about the phi j's. So I presume you're defining the phi j's for individual samples when you're
yes.
doing these scaling plots.
Yes.
And so there's a question of what is the fluctuation in the size of the phi j's. And so if you're looking at something that's approaching a phi j that is sample specific, you like in other non-equilibrium phase transitions, you'll see something that's due to microscopic behavior that's not due to it's not a collective exponent. It's something that reflects something that you can, you understand what I'm saying? So you're well within a finite size regime, so you're
so
not really looking at
this.
The true critical behavior,
so,
possibly.
So I have, with the same data on another project, we've looked at the scaling of mechanical properties as we go right to jamming. So we've looked at overlaps, we've looked at G of R, you know, the pair distribution.
The question that's being asked is, are you subtracting the 5J for the particular system
yes.
and then averaging, or are you
averaging? No, I'm subtracting the 5J for the particular system and then averaging. And I feel confident in doing that because we've previously shown in other work that the scalings, the mechanical scalings around jamming are independent of the particular phi j that we use for these exact same systems.
Well, it could be that you have very high precision data, so you're seeing something different then, because there are systems, when you do subtract off individually, you can get different exponents.
Yeah, so all I can say is I don't think that that's the case, because with this this mechanical, the mechanical analysis that I've done, and this is a paper with Patrick Charbonneau and Francesco Zamponi and Giorgio Parisi, that we found scalings in the data right at jamming which were consistent with the predictions of their replica theory of jamming. And so it, yes?
Have you tried it the other way?
So if you try it the other way, you blur everything out. Yeah.
And probably when you try
to
get exponents, you get different exponents.
So it depends. So if you try it the other way, yeah. So this system is big enough that the phi j is very well peaked.
You're doing it my way. Not Alan's way, but it is.
Well, I'm happy to be in the middle of this argument.
I'm going to propose we move to another question from this.
Yes.
So I thought your data on the rescaled eccentricity was particularly interesting, and
yes.
I was wondering, sort of in light that we're going to hear a talk later about Martin-Siddick transitions, have you thought about sort of, I don't know, like a Landau theory or something for this eccentricity parameter, given that it's so important, and given that there's sort of a change from something which is sort of aspect ratio 1 to not aspect ratio 1 on either side of the transition, do you think you could recouch that in some sort of field theoretic way?
I mean, that's the goal, right? The goal is to go from this empirical observation to a field theory. And so we're working on it. We haven't made much good progress. And so if people have ideas, if you have ideas, we are all ears. It does seem like there's something interesting about aspect ratio and eccentricity because of the way that these Voronoi cells have to fit together. If one cell has a very long side, then the cell adjoining it must also have a very long side, since there has to be that symmetry present.
I think we're sort of running out. So one last question I think we have time for. So Sid, and then the others, please.
A general question. I'm curious to know about how you connect the jamming transition with the glass transition. So in analogy to phi j, is there a temperature that you have in mind?
So the connection is not mine. I certainly can't claim responsibility for it. But the connection that's claimed is that this point here at zero temperature and zero applied shear and phi j is controlling the region around it. And now there's been lots and lots and lots of debate about how big that region would be. So it doesn't directly map to a TJ, although there are people in the audience who are much more expert on this than I.
Thank you.
So thanks, Eric, and I think we need to move to Eric too.
Thank you.
And so he and